Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's the News Roundup, where we discuss some of the stories making regional news this week. Federal agencies began a partial shutdown just after midnight on Wednesday because Congress cannot agree on a funding bill. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers are expected to be furloughed, and many public services have been reduced. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here to talk about how the shutdown is affecting our region. She'll also share a lighter story about a boat tour off Monomoy looking for great white sharks. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, good to be here.
So let's start with the shutdown. We know that some federal workers considered essential are still on the job. Can you talk about who's included in that?
The biggest category is things that are related to public safety. So law enforcement functions like the FBI are working. Virtually all of the Department of Homeland Security is working. That includes Border Patrol, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Emergency Management, and also the Coast Guard. It's not every single person in those agencies, but most of them. Another thing that gets talked about a lot in a shutdown is the airports. So we know air traffic controllers are working. So are the screeners with the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA. We know that new paychecks for those folks will generally not be coming until the shutdown ends. So in that sense, they are working without pay, you might say. I talked to Mike Nelson about this. He is the airport manager at the Cape Cod Gateway Airport in Hyannis. He says they have six or seven TSA workers there. Usually it kind of varies by the time of year. And he says flights are operating normally. The screeners are working. But to his knowledge, they are not getting paid, at least as of the next paycheck.
But they get back pay eventually, right?
Right. Once the shutdown ends, the federal employees do get back pay. Cape Cod's air traffic controllers actually work for a private contractor, and I cannot really speak to their pay arrangements. I called the contractor, did not hear back. But in terms of people working without pay, again, that is going to kind of become a bigger issue in about 2 weeks at the end of the pay period. So the shutdown started on October 1st, and that was a federal payday. So from my understanding, at least some workers, probably all workers, did get paid that day. So, you know, their first paycheck would be late in 2 weeks.
We also have two National Park Service sites in our immediate listening area, the Cape Cod National Seashore and the New Bedford Whaling National Historic Park. How are they faring in the shutdown?
Well, I have not been able to go out to them in person. We do know the Cape Cod Times reported that the Salt Pond Visitor Center was locked on Wednesday. I called the New Bedford Visitor Center yesterday at various times of day, and they never picked up the phone. So it is highly likely, I would say, that some of the public-facing buildings are closed. I did get through to the National Seashore staff on Wednesday. They referred me to the sort of larger National Park Service media office for the whole country, which is something they've been doing ever since President Trump took office. And the Park Service says they're doing what they can to keep the parks accessible during the shutdown. And they do have people, again, working in sort of safety-related functions. But they would not answer any questions about, you know, our local parks and what's closed and what's open.
All right. What about other federal agencies in the area?
Well, Social Security is one that comes to mind. Social Security checks will not be interrupted, but the local offices are doing fewer in-person functions than they normally do because not everyone's working. And we actually have a full list of what they are doing in the story on our website about the shutdown. One thing I did not think about until I talked with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about the shutdown is that for nonprofits, even if a group has grants that are not directly affected by the shutdown, some of their work could be disrupted if it involves interacting with federal agencies on a day-to-day basis and, like, no one's picking up the phone or answering the email, you know, at those agencies. And an interesting stat I saw is that the Congressional Budget Office says the back pay for those folks who are not actually on the job costs $400 million a day.
Wow. All right, let's move on to a feature story you produced that's kind of an experimental piece. It's going out on a white shark tour, with great white sharks showing up off Cape Cod in greater numbers in recent years. These boat tours have become pretty popular, but they're a little bit pricey. Tell us about your tour.
Yes, I took what is called an open boat tour with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. It was called open boat because you can just buy a ticket and get on instead of chartering the whole boat, which until pretty recently was the way to get on a small boat anyway for sharks. So this is still a small boat experience. It's a 35-foot fishing boat. It was me and five other passengers, along with the tour guide from the Conservancy and then the boat captain. We left from Chatham. We went down through the cut in the sandbar to Monomoy, where there are, of course, a lot of seals hanging out on the beach, and the sharks are patrolling the shallow waters around there. So that's, as they call it, Shark Alley, and a good place to look. The way they find the sharks is with a spotter plane. So the pilot would give our captain directions about where to go, and then we would just head right over to the shark and see them. Sometimes they'd be near the surface. Sometimes they were, you know, lower in the water.
So how many sharks did you see, and what were the sightings like?
Well, I would say it's about seven sharks that we saw, although, you know, some clearer than others, but that's a pretty good number. Generally, we would be able to see kind of the outline of the shark and some of its tail movement. The day we went, the water was actually a little bit rough. One of the passengers who was out there with me said she had taken two seasickness pills and she still was too ill to be in the front of the boat. So that just gives you a sense of, like, even though it was a nice day, like, the swells were pretty big, and that affects your view of the sharks a little bit. But we did see them, and we also saw a mola mola, an ocean sunfish. That was up very close because it was right next to the boat and its dorsal fin was up out of the water. So that was pretty cool.
Some of these passengers traveled from pretty far away, right?
Yes. Some were local. One woman came from Connecticut. She said that she's always been passionate about marine animals, and she has done some other tours on the Cape before, but this was her first time doing this one. Another woman actually came all the way from Wisconsin specifically to do this shark tour. Her name is Bridget Young. And she said that she grew up in the Pacific Northwest in the vicinity of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. And out there, they have this, like, legend about an impossibly large octopus living under the bridge. And so she said she just feels like there's this kind of lore around sea animals that kind of inspired her love of sharks.
All right, let's talk about the cost for a minute. A tour like this costs much less than a private charter, but it's still pretty expensive.
That is right. So the ticket for this tour, which again is a very small group, was $500 per person. That is much less than a private charter, which runs about $2,000 for the charter. However, larger boats do shark and whale tours and things like that. On a boat, you know, like on a boat the size of a big whale watch boat, where there are hundreds of people on board, that brings the cost down. I talked with the state's head shark biologist, Greg Scomel, about this trip, and we did talk a little bit about the cost. He said it's harder for those big boats to get into the shallow water where the best viewing is. Some of them do go into pretty shallow water, but he says that can be dicey. So that's one of the advantages of the small boat. And Scomel also pointed out that doing one of these tours, even at the $2,000, is way cheaper than how some other people have viewed sharks by cage diving, which is illegal in Massachusetts. And so if you're traveling to some warm destination and doing cage diving, he says that's going to cost like $5,000 to $10,000.
Wow. All right. And you reported that peak season for seeing great whites off Cape Cod has been changing.
Yeah. So Greg Scomel says the peak season has been getting later in the last couple of years, moving from August into September. His team was tagging some smaller great whites in Cape Cod Bay in August, but a lot of the larger sharks are bypassing the Cape at that time of year, they believe, and going up to Canada. So he says the Gulf of Maine is great habitat, plenty of seals. So the hypothesis right now is that they're bypassing the Cape on their way north and then hanging out here a little bit more on the way back south. And so that's why they're here later.
Yeah. What kind of research are he and other shark scientists working on right now?
Well, as we know, they've been kind of studying the presence of sharks off the Cape for years. They have the acoustic tagging, the tag detection and all of that. What they're starting to focus on now is more of the fine scale movements, the small movements of the sharks as they are hunting off the Cape. And the idea behind that is to protect public safety, because scientists want to learn more about how sharks are doing their predation so they can help people stay safer when they're in the water.
All right. Thank you, CAI's Jeanette Barnes. And we're going to hear that shark story a little bit later in the hour. Thank you, Jeanette.
All right. Thanks, Mindy.
October is here, and for some locals, that means the start of the recreational bay scallop season. And with that in mind, CAI's science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes brought us a story this week about bay scallops' favorite habitat, eelgrass. Amy's here to talk about that. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, other than scalloping season, why is eelgrass in the news?
So eelgrass is our local species of seagrass, and scientists who are studying seagrasses are learning a lot about how they have a positive impact on the environment through increased biodiversity, erosion control, and even global warming. I spoke with Agnes Mittermeier. She works for the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown, and she's also the director of a global seagrass monitoring organization called SeagrassNet. And she said scientists have recently discovered that seagrasses are incredibly good at capturing and storing carbon. In fact, she says they're more efficient at doing that job than even the Amazon rainforest.
That's amazing. So why is that?
Well, seagrass meadows have extensive root systems, and so the grasses can capture carbon from their surroundings and channel it into the ground through those roots. And Mittermeier noted that algae is also good at capturing carbon, but without roots, it lacks the ability to store it in the ground. And those root systems are what make seagrass beds so effective for storm protection and erosion as well.
Is SeagrassNet looking to propagate more seagrass beds?
Well, according to Mittermeier, seagrasses need some pretty specific conditions to thrive. So, yes, they do work on seagrass meadow restoration projects, but they put a lot of effort into picking the right spots. She says it takes about 2 years to pick a project.
And so how do you go about restoring a seagrass bed?
There are actually two ways. Seagrasses flower and produce seeds, so you can gather and plant those seeds somewhere else. But instead, conservationists sometimes choose to transplant grown grasses, roots and all. And either way, it takes about a year to know if the project was successful. And seagrasses can also spread through rhizomes, which create clones. So fun fact, the world's largest single living organism based on area is a 77 square mile patch of seagrass in Shark Bay off Western Australia.
Ooh, interesting. All right, a little closer to home, you also had a story about sea turtle strikes this week.
Yes, a recently released study published in the journal Biological Conservation identified the waters off Cape Cod as an especially deadly place for leatherback sea turtles struck by boats and other watercraft.
And how was this data collected?
So local rescue organizations up and down the East Coast and along the Gulf Coast contributed reports from their stranding data. So people see a stranded sea turtle and they call up their local rescue organization. That's the data they use. So the figures are just the turtles that were seen and reported as stranded.
How are numbers still high?
Yeah, so Mass Audubon staff and Wellfleet contributed to our local data, and it came from stranded turtle reports they received between 2010 and 2022. So for the report, 337 leatherbacks were struck by watercraft throughout the whole study area, and 88 of those, or 26%, were here in Barnstable and Duke counties. And of those 88, 96% of the turtles struck locally died. But we aren't seeing as many leatherbacks in recent years, so the strike numbers are down too. I spoke with Karen Dordeville. She's the sea turtle research coordinator for Mass Audubon, and she said there's evidence to suggest leatherbacks are spending more time in cooler Canadian waters, much like we talked about with sharks. So that's where their favorite lion's mane jellyfish thrive, and those are cold-loving jellyfish. She said so far this year they've received reports of just 7 deceased leatherbacks, and 5 of those, she said, were definitely killed from vessel strikes. But she noted the season isn't over. She said we typically see leatherbacks on our waters through October at least.
Do they know why the leatherbacks are getting struck here more than other sea turtles?
There are likely a few contributing factors. First of all, Dordeville noted we just have a lot of boat traffic here. But also, these turtles are really big. They can grow to be 10 feet long and weigh 1,000 pounds, so probably not the most agile turtles. Plus, they tend to swim and feed right near the surface where the boats are.
All right. Thank you, CAI's science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyce. Thank you, Amy. A school speaker on Nantucket creating some controversy, Jason Grazia Day with the Nantucket Current, is here with details on that. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
All right, so what's going on with this school speaker? Are there, what, policy changes because of it?
Yeah, so, you know, the day after the Nantucket High School brought in a motivational speaker named Max Dutton, who is a former Marine and motivational speaker, parents and students received an email from Superintendent Beth Hallett saying that the school is going to be revising its policy on how it vets these visiting speakers and really addressed some of the concerns that were brought up by teachers and parents in the aftermath of his visit to Nantucket High School. Now, it wasn't necessarily anything that he said during that speaking engagement, but parents and students looked on his social media, you know, shortly after he came and saw some things that they described as very objectionable, misogynistic videos and posts on his Instagram page that really raised concerns for them and made them question how the school is reviewing and vetting who they bring in to speak to students.
Right. And as we mentioned a few minutes ago, scallop season, it's October.
It's October. Yeah, the season opened on Wednesday for the recreational scallop season. Now, this is a month that the island residents get to head out to the waters, whether you're push raking or diving, to get out ahead of the commercial season, which begins on November 1st. So it was a pretty windy, blustery day to open, but people were still out there, out in Mattaket Harbor and Pocomo, other areas of Nantucket Harbor. So it's a time of year that people really enjoy out here on Nantucket, for sure.
And water's still pretty warm, really.
Water's still pretty warm. Yep, people are still out swimming, and looks like we're going to have some really great weather coming up here. So I think people will be out in even greater numbers coming up here in the next couple of days.
Yeah, for sure. A little bit of Hollywood there. You've got the filming of Five Star Weekend going on.
Yeah, the stars were out here on the island. There was a crew from Universal Productions that has been filming what will be the film adaptation of island author Ellen Hildebrand's novel, Five Star Weekend. So you had Jennifer Garner, a number of other actresses out filming scenes all around the island. So the select board earlier this year did okay the filming. So there was a number of road closures. They were out on Main Street, Sconset, various locations, even the Stop and Shop and the Chicken Box. So people have been sort of stargazing and out and seeing some of the, you know, Gemma Chan, Regina Hall, Darcy Carden. And again, the other night, all of the actresses got up and did a little karaoke at the Gaslight, which is a bar in downtown Nantucket. It was a really cute video that they got up with our local ghost tour guide, Bill Jameson, as he was singing ABBA's Dancing Queen. It's a pretty funny video. You can check it out on our website. So it's been made for an interesting September here on the island.
Yeah, now, nice to get up close and personal and see that, right? See what's happening. All right. And then finally, we've got a new library head.
That's right. So the Nantucket Athenaeum named one of its own this week to lead the library, and that is Leslie Malcolm. She had been serving as the interim head of the library since May. And the library made it official this week that she is going to be its new executive director and head librarian moving forward. A lot of positive feedback, people really happy for Leslie and glad to see the next head librarian in place. She becomes only the 10th librarian in the Athenaeum's nearly 200-year history.
That's amazing.
So she's following in the footsteps of people like Mariah Mitchell, the first professional female astronomer on the island, who was appointed to that post when she was just 18 years old. So a lot of history. And, you know, this is a beloved institution on the island. So we wish her the best in that role.
Yeah. All right. Jason Grazie from the Nantucket Current. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, a new buyer for the West Harwich Baptist Church and concerns that Provincetown is losing some of its nostalgic charm. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Climate change, of course, impacting us all, but it is perhaps more dramatic in coastal communities like Chatham. The Chatham Climate Action Network brought together four experts to talk about the risk. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So tell us a little bit about this, the talk from the experts.
Sure. There was, as you said, a panel of four experts, which included a couple of town staff members who deal with coastal resilience on an almost daily basis. And they basically, they did a lot of sort of background information about what climate change is and, you know, sort of presenting evidence that climate change is real despite what we hear from some quarters in this country. And they basically talked about how vulnerable we are here on the coast, especially, you know, Cape Cod and down here in Chatham. You know, the Cape has more than 147 miles of road and billions of dollars worth of property that's within 5 feet of sea level, which one of the panelists pointed out, that's the level that was the storm surge during Hurricane Sandy. So It's not out of the realm of possibility that something like that could hit us here and have create extensive damage.
Yeah.
But, you know, they also said that, you know, we're lucky that we're in Massachusetts because state agencies take this issue seriously, even if we're starting to see federal support fall off for any kind of climate resilient programs. And so, you know, we've got grants that are coming through from the state and programs that support communities' efforts. You know, here in Chatham, they've done things like elevate the pump station, new sewer pump stations, so they're above flood level. And when they renovated the fish pier here a couple years ago, they built the docks. They elevated them. Now they couldn't elevate them as high as they should have to protect from storm surge, because then what the town officials said, fishermen wouldn't be able to reach their boats to offload their catches because it would be too high.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is that, you know, we're in a place that's more vulnerable, but we're also in a place where people are more aware of the situation. So it's sort of a good, bad situation.
Yeah. There. And not only a risk, but talk about mitigation as well. All right. So what's the latest on the West Harwich Baptist Church?
So last week we reported that the Davenport companies, which had planned to purchase the church and create housing there, they had also wanted to demolish the building, which is historic, built in the 1880s. They said it wasn't structurally sound, but after they got pushback from that, they decided to drop out of that process. And that left an opening for John Carey, who's a local developer who recently developed the historic West Harwich schoolhouse building, which is right across the street from the Baptist Church. He developed that into housing. And what his plan is for the Baptist Church is to create a sort of community center in the building. He's going to preserve the existing building, renovate it historically in a historically accurate way. But he said he wants to create a community center for the West Harwich area. And as you know, we've also reported there are a number of housing projects in that area, and there's been a very big effort to you know, preserve the property and make that area into a historic showplace. So this sort of fits right in with all those plans that are currently in process.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea. All right, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
32-year-old New Bedford resident Pascual Queen Gonzalez was detained at three different ICE facilities in three different states, all in the span of 6 days. That's according to Kevin Andrade of the New Bedford Light. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with Kevin recently to learn more.
Let's start with the basics. Who are Pascual Queen Gonzalez and Manuela Morales Gonzalez?
They are a couple who live in New Bedford. They work at an agricultural business outside of New Bedford. And on September 12th, early in the morning, they were on their way to work when all of a sudden ERO, or Enforcement and Removal Operations Officers, which is the ICE arm that carries out street arrests, stopped them and took them into custody.
Can you kind of walk me through what happened to this couple on September 12th?
So at 6:30 a.m., they see the blue lights behind them. They pull over. They say that there were four officers who spoke Spanish, and they asked for ID. And there were two female officers who said their driver's license would be fine. But according to Pascual, two male agents said, no, that's not enough. Pascual has asylum and has a work permit, and Manuela has work permit and is an asylum seeker. They attempted to hand them over, and they said they were not examined at the site. And at one point, Manuela saw the situation was escalating, so she went to grab her phone. And according to her, an agent tried to snap it out of her hands. And that's when she turned around and saw that Pascual was being held up against the door in a way that he said was very, very strong. Bien duro was his words. Then they were brought in a car. Manuela said she was crying the whole time, asking to speak to her daughters. And at one point, one of the female agents said, you need to calm down, loudly and rudely, according to Manuela. She started to interrogate her about her criminal history. And then they got to a place that sounds like Britland Park, which is a soccer field behind the Fall River Police Department. And that's where the couple were separated.
So they let Manuela go. And then what happened to Pascual?
So they brought Manuela back to New Bedford. Pascual stood in the car for several hours. He saw two other men be brought in, one from New Bedford and another from Ecuador, and he said both were let go and that the agents apologized to them for the inconvenience. And then in the afternoon, they brought him up to Burlington where he was processed. He stood in Burlington, which is the ICE field office that I had previously reported on as having horrible conditions for detainees. And the following day, he was taken to Hanscom Air Force Base, placed on a plane, and flown out to the Buffalo Service Processing Center, which is an immigrant detention facility in Batavia, New York. A few days later, he was flown out again to an ICE facility in Pine Prairie, Louisiana. There, he took his first shower in 5 days, and he said that that's where he was finally released and had to find his own way home. His employer was willing to pay for his ticket, so he was able to get a plane ticket from Lafayette, Louisiana, all the way to Boston, and he reunited with Manuela.
Do we have any idea as to why Pascual was detained and what's going to happen to him next?
So the only indication we have is a letter that he received from Catholic Charities, who was representing his case, and they said that he had asylum granted to him back in 2021 under his mother. According to the letter, he was supposed to adjust his status. He had not done so. And as a result, they initiated removal proceedings. He said that shortly after he submitted his application for legal permanent residency, he's going to be going to immigration court in March.
You spoke to some legal experts for this story. What were their takes on what happened to Pascual?
They said that it appeared that it was an attempt to circumvent due process, although nobody was willing to say that definitely. This was all theoretically. Corinne Williams, who's the director of the Community Economic Development Center of Southeastern Massachusetts, which is based in New Bedford, she said that this is absolutely a case of racial profiling.
That's Kevin Andrade of the New Bedford Light. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Gilda.
Superintendent of Schools on the Vineyard announces plans to retire, taking some by surprise. Sarah Shaw Dawson with the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. So we're surprised to hear that the superintendent's leaving, I guess, moving off island, right?
Yeah. So it definitely came as a surprise to community and school members. He does have some time left on his contract. And there's quite a few ongoing initiatives at the high school and public schools right now. But he said in an interview with the MB Times that he's moving back to Virginia to care for his wife's parents. They're in need of some extra health support. So he'll be stepping down from his post in June of 2026. Yeah. And the committee has some time to find a replacement in that time frame.
Yeah. And tough shoes to fill, right?
Definitely. The resounding sentiment from the All Island School Committee after his announcement was one of thanks and just a lot of gratefulness for his work at the public schools here. He's had a really long tenure at local schools, both elementary and middle, and the central office. And in that time, he's really prioritized student safety and equity. He's helped cultivate the English language learning programs for students who are learning English as their second language. He's advocated for students with socioeconomic challenges, and he's pushed for regionalization efforts for supporting the youth of the island.
Mm. And you might not notice some issues at the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School just walking in, but closer inspection will show what asbestos, leaking pipes, mold, and out-of-date mechanical systems.
Yeah, the building project has been on the drawing table for nearly a decade due to some of those issues you mentioned. But school officials have said it's gotten far worse during that time. It takes a long time for some capital projects to get underway, but with issues like mold, they feel real urgency to get this done. The mold has gotten a lot worse due to pipe leaks and floods, and the asbestos, which is under a protective cover under the floor tiles of the school in some areas, has been exposed a few times. And repaired along the way. And even when I went to take some photos of the school before publishing the article, the custodians showed me a ceiling tile that had been removed and said that a room had flooded just days before the school opened this year. So years ago, these instances were fewer and far between, but the decline of the building is pretty evident at this point.
And of course, it's going to be costly to fix. Thank you, Sarah Shaw Dawson from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Is Provincetown starting to lose its nostalgic charm? Sarah Rahal from the Boston Globe joins us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You have a piece in the Globe this week that looks at concerns over changes in Provincetown and maybe some lessons learned from other communities that have undergone gentrification. And one area you note change is the unique inns that are becoming more rare.
I'm new to Massachusetts. I'm actually from Detroit. And when I came to work at the Globe, I found it notorious that people were talking about going to the Cape like they were going up North Michigan. Like that is just the place that everyone goes to vacation, to reconnect with family and loved ones and just have a good time, relax. And I am just immersing myself in all things that make Massachusetts special. And one thing that I'm learning is that the very tip of the Cape is so historical for so many reasons, and not just from being a traditional fishing town or the Pilgrim's First Landing to being a Portuguese enclave, but also for its unapologetic individuality and acceptance of people who just really want to express themselves and be safe in a community that is primarily LGBTQ focused. And people characterize to me what makes this place so special is its history. And one of those things that encompasses it are these century-old buildings that are known for their inns. Inns, hotels, these terms are kind of flip-flopped interchangeably. These inns probably are no more than a dozen rooms. If you're lucky, you find one that is probably more than three or four rooms, has some sort of pool or a nice garden to sit in and have coffee or on the porch. Or usually it's a couple that runs it, lives there too, cooks you breakfast, and kind of keeps operations very homegrown. And what makes it the inn special are these people who not just greet you by your name or remember you when you come back, but they instruct you on where to go and how to make the most out of P-Town, kind of living in this character. Mm. And one thing we noticed is that people who were recommending me to go to the Cape and specifically to go to P-Town were recommending to go to these smaller places because I, as a newcomer, would be able to immerse myself in something that I wouldn't be able to get from TripAdvisor or Google. So much of our culture these days relies on social media recommendations, and this isn't typically from people who are there year-round. And one way to find those year-round residents are to look at the inn owners or innkeepers that are going to be there no matter what, and they know what's best, and to make sure that you have a good time that suits your needs. So I started looking. Where do I stay? Where do I go? How do I have fun? I could not find anywhere to stay. Everywhere was max capacity, no vacancies. I was looking to go the week after Carnival, which was my first mistake. Everyone works tirelessly in August to suit a need of people who flood P-Town to go to Carnival. And some people even book more than a year out to stay at their favorite places. And this not only shocked me, but the places that I could find to stay all had a crazy sticker shock for me of $400 or $500 a night. That was without the minimum stays, sometimes 2 to 3 nights. And then on top of all of that, it felt like there was another almost 20% tax to stay there. I'm a frequent traveler, and these prices were equivalent to Chicago, places that I didn't expect to see something that's a ferry ride away be so expensive, and also was never in my books compared to Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket. So, yeah, that's what led us on this journey.
And so what we're seeing is some larger corporations coming in and buying up some of this property, right? So the town did put in some new bylaws in April, no more than owning 5 hotels and 2 short-term rentals. Is that starting to have any kind of an impact?
It looks to be so. The town has lost about almost 20 inns in the process, but it's not just due to these caps. The caps were implemented after one major player kind of dominated 30% of the market. We won't see a direct impact from it just yet, but we can say that the bigger operators who own 2 to 3 places are probably not going to invest as much going forward. That could have an impact in the taxes, in the hotel capacity, and in turn, culture.
And one of the things you know, part of the challenge in Provincetown is balancing progress and preservation.
What will these people do once they do acquire a property? The residents, longtime residents, and innkeepers noted that former inns are becoming housing for employees of those hotels. So, how do we keep the inns intact while also making way for what's to come?
One of the things that makes Provincetown so charming and still remains is how welcoming it is.
I felt that immediate, as you can read from the story. It's such a colorful place. There's no one that wasn't smiling in P-Town. I think I needed like a tissue, and someone like handed me one before I could even ask for it. My husband and I went and ate at Sal's Fine Dining right on like the water, and we sat down, realized that it was cash only by the menu, and before we could even get up and say we're sorry, we don't have any cash, they were like, bring the check back tomorrow, enjoy your dinner, please have a seat. In what world would that be? Okay. Yes, it's a very generous place.
Yeah. So as locals are fighting to keep the charm in Provincetown, we have every indication that it will remain so, right?
I would hope. It's not for me to say. They really want to keep a year-round community. And I think that's what we're going to start seeing a change. If more places are turning inns into single-family homes for people to stay year-round, what happens to the tourism industry that the town relies on so heavily?
Yeah, lots of questions. Sarah Rahal from the Boston Globe. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we check in on the latest news from the State House and head out on a boat tour searching for great white sharks.
I got books, I got my music, I'm healthy. No, I'm having a great time now.
What kind of music do you like?
Bruce Springsteen, big Bruce fan. Screen Door Slams. What's your name?
Barbara.
Barbara's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as a radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me, and I want you to own me.
Don't turn me home again. I just can't face myself alone again.
Whenever I feel down, I put on Bruce. A lot of people don't like them, but I put on Bruce and I just cheers me up.
John Fidalgo, used bookstore owner and music lover in Fall River. You're listening to WCAI, local public radio for the Cape Coast and Islands.
And you're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. State officials meet with solar energy industry leaders. A familiar face returns to the Cannabis Control Commission. And another Republican gubernatorial hopeful throws his hat into the ring. CAI's Gilda Geis heard the latest on these stories from State House reporter Katie Lannon.
This week, Governor Maura Healey and other state officials met with leaders in the solar energy industry. Can you give us the highlights?
Yeah, the message that Healey and the industry leaders here were really trying to convey is that solar is the cheapest and fastest way to get new power online, and that Massachusetts is committed to it as an option, even as under the Trump administration, some tax credits to encourage solar are set to expire. So this meeting, which became a closed-door huddle, the press was kicked out of the room after the opening statements, was really about the business groups trying to let state officials know where the roadblocks are and maybe what they can do to help Massachusetts regain its status as a leader in solar energy.
And Shannon O'Brien is back at the helm of the Cannabis Control Commission this week after she was fired for alleged on-the-job misconduct, which a judge recently ruled was not enough cause for her termination. So how did her first meeting back on the job go, and how are the other commissioners reacting?
This was a regular business meeting for the CCC that they pretty much focused on their licensing reviews and approvals more so than any of the drama that's been going on for years now. Shannon O'Brien herself is describing her return as a new beginning, and she is outlining a series of priorities. She says she wants to kind of work through some of the regulations that might make things more expensive or too difficult for small businesses and get rid of those, really limit them. She also wants to double down on the commitment to supporting people who have been harmed by the war on drugs and providing stronger oversight for testing labs. So there's going to be a lot, it seems like, on the commission's plate as they move forward.
Also this week, a new Republican candidate has entered the governor's race. Can you introduce us?
Yeah, this is Michael Minogue. He is from the North Shore. He is an Army veteran and the former CEO of a medical device company. He is probably best known in political circles as a major donor to Republicans, both on the state and national levels, something that the Democratic Party here in Massachusetts has already latched onto, tying him to Donald Trump. And, you know, there'll be a chance for voters to learn more about him this Sunday when he is airing his first campaign ad during the Patriots game.
And remind us, who were Minogue's opponents in this race and when is the election?
Minogue in the Republican primary will be squaring off against Mike Keneally and Brian Shortsleeve, both of whom served under former Governor Charlie Baker. Keneally was his housing secretary, housing and economic development. And Shortsleeve led the T under Baker. So that's at least three names so far. And that GOP primary will take place on September 1st next year. It's an early one this year before Labor Day. The winner will go on to face off likely against Governor Healey, who is running for re-election that November.
That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Maybe you've been on a whale watch or know someone who has, but what about a trip to see great white sharks? As CAI's Jeanette Barnes talked about earlier in the hour, she joined one of a growing number of tours open to the public.
The water at Riders Cove in Chatham gleams with September morning sun. Five guests, all women, board a vessel captained by Alexander Carrier.
So life jackets are in this bench right here. This right bench. The way that you get to those is you just kind of rip the cushion off. It's just Velcroed on there.
It's a 35-foot boat of the type often used for charter fishing. But the only thing they'll be fishing for today is an eyeful of a feared and fascinating ocean predator.
Three rules on the boat. Rule number one, don't fall in. Rule number two, if you fall in, don't pet the sharks. Rule number three. And then rule number three, anytime we're moving, especially fast, you just want to stay seated.
Trips to see great white sharks on a small boat like this typically set you back about $2,000 for a private charter. But in recent years, some companies and the nonprofit Atlantic White Shark Conservancy have started offering a ticket-based trip. This one with the conservancy costs $500 per person. One thing driving the cost is the spotter plane. The pilot finds sharks from above and radios the boat captain. We're heading down toward Monomoy, and our spotter plane has just come into view. Our guide for this trip is Hannah Leary, ecotourism coordinator for the Shark Conservancy.
They can move up to 25 miles an hour when they're hunting, but when they're just swimming around, they average 5 miles an hour. It's like a game of Marco Polo between us, the plane, the shark, and all three of us are moving, so.
We change the position of the boat to cut down on glare, and then there it is, 1.5 boat lengths away. This is the height of white shark season. Peak sightings off the Outer Cape have shifted later in the last couple of years, from August toward September, says state shark biologist Greg Scomel. He tags sharks for research.
One of the things we did in the last several months was we published a paper showing that the number of white sharks going to Canada is increasing.
Although water temperature affects the movement of sharks, Scomel says they're also following their food. Waters off Canada and Maine offer plenty of what sharks like to eat, especially seals.
Perhaps some of the sharks we would typically see on Cape Cod in July and August as they migrate north just bypass us, but then they come through on their way south. So that's the working hypothesis we've got right now, and we'll see how the numbers bear out when we start to exchange information with our Canadian colleagues.
Back on the tour, guest Bridget Young has been kneeling on a seat in the bow to get a better view of each white shark.
I'm originally from the Pacific Northwest, but I live in Madison, Wisconsin right now.
In her work life, she's a mental health therapist. She traveled solo all this way just to see great whites in the wild.
I think a big part of it was growing up in the Pacific Northwest. Like, we had the mythical huge octopus that lived under the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. So there's a lot of like lore around sea animals, and I think that was what sparked my interest the most.
Next up, a shark the captain says is 11 or 12 feet long.
Guys, so here's the shark right off the 1 o'clock. This is a big shark, guys. This is a big shark.
Following in, not here, not now.
Whoa. Our guide lowers a hydrophone, like an underwater microphone, beneath the surface to check for an acoustic tag.
This is listening for the tag right now, so if the shark is tagged, it will start to make these clicking noises, and that's the pings that the acoustic tag is putting off. So it's almost like a serial number. They each put off different frequencies.
No tag on this one, but we get to see the shark in just 10 feet of water, and nearby, a huge seal haul-out. Gray seals crowd together on the beach at Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. That's a big reason the sharks are here in shallow water. Young says seeing them in the wild has been surreal.
I think it's such a neat experience to get to see animals that, you know, might not exist forever. To me, it just feels very cool.
The sightings will contribute to research by scientists who work closely together for the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and the state of Massachusetts. They're studying sharks' predatory behavior off Cape Cod, aiming to minimize conflicts between humans and the great white.
Woo! Magical.
Off Chatham, I'm Jeanette Barnes for CAI.
And that wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.